Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
What is going on, everybody? Hope you are having a wonderful week so far. Before we start, if you are listening to this, I'd love it if you subscribed, give us a little review, anything you can do to share. It just means the podcast reaches a bigger audience and means that more people listen, which means I can get better guests for you all. So thank you very much to everybody that does listen. Podcast time, good boys. Good boys. Don't really need much introduction. Their first big record that came out was with Medusa's Peace for Your Heart, which is currently, as I record this, is at just on Spotify alone in 968 million streams. Then the follow-up was Lose Control, which is nearly at 900 million streams. And they're at 12 million monthly listeners on Spotify. So realistically, I don't need to give them an introduction. However, I spent quite a bit of time with them on EDC ship, and really enjoyed hanging out with them. They're absolutely lovely guys, extremely talented guys as well. And I really wanted to like get them on, talk about their story and kind of talk about the ups and downs of having hit records and building a career in what we call the music industry. So I will stop rambling on and let the podcast start without further ado. Good boys. Josh and Ethan, aka Good Boys. What is cooking, lads? How are you?
Very good, thank you. It's 10 in the morning, which is earlier than we normally start, but other than that, we're very good. How are you?
Yeah, thanks for coming on so early. It's a day of podcast recording for me today. So it's good to get you boys
on. You today?
Yeah, I've got four today if everyone turns up.
Oh my god. Wow.
Yeah, it's do you ever do like multiple sessions in one day when you're writing songs?
Sometimes, yeah.
Yeah, yesterday was a mega day. I did three yesterday.
Oh, how do you do that, man?
Back to back to back. Well, I was lucky to be working with some awesome people.
Yeah.
But it is a little bit draining, and you have to have a list of ideas to fall back on because nobody's that inspired.
Yeah, I've never done everyone's always like, how do you do like 3, 4, 5 podcasts in a day? And I'm like, well, it's pretty easy because the like if you're reasonably okay at conversation and the other person, the people you're talking to, are reasonably good at conversation, you can keep going. But like, yeah, when it comes to writing sessions, I've been in sessions where like I'm leaving and the person that I'm in with is like, oh, I've got to go do another session now. I'm like, that is just sounds draining.
Yeah, it's hectic, isn't it?
I'm right there with you, Will. I'm spent after, you know, one session, two songs, maybe three, and then I think it's the changing of location that I find exhausting. And really? Then the meeting of new people. Do you know what I mean? Like, you go from one session to the other, and then there's lots of, like, obviously, you don't want to just jump straight into a song. You still have to, like, do the niceties and things. And then I think the social side of it can be you know, a little bit taxing as well on a day like that.
I agree, because how do you guys go into a session? I know we're jumping into things and there's a lot of intros to kind of talk about this, but we're jumping massively into this. But going into sessions, for me, like, the whole point for me about writing with somebody is like the social side of it. It's like the bond between me and the writer, me and the singer, me and the producer, like whoever I'm in with. For me, it's like, can I make, is this person going to be somebody that's in my life for a long period of time? And like, can I build a relationship up with them so that even if we don't make the best music, we have a fucking cool friendship and there's like something cool at the end of all of this. It's not just business. Do you guys go in with that same, like, how do you guys work with that?
Yeah, I mean, I think when you are getting started, there's a bit of speed dating that goes on where, like, if you, you know, if you haven't come into the industry as part of a band or like a group of friends that are all musicians, there's going to be that period of speed dating where you do loads of sessions with loads of different people. But I think now we've sort of rounded the wagons a bit and we've got a small group of people that we like to work with.
Josh is the only one person that I know, by the way, who uses the most ye old man sayings in the world. And I still don't even know what they mean, but he uses them in enough context that I could kind of guess. But he's like, we're going to round the wagons. I'm like, I'm in. What does that mean?
Yeah, no outsiders. No outsiders anymore. Just like the crew. So I think for our stuff, that's kind of the way we approach it. Is like, there's a group of people we know and like working with. And then if we write for other people, sort of, then it goes a bit broader.
And
yeah, and I'm glad that you said that, Will, because I think that's the way that we've been, like Josh said, we've really, that's relatively recent for us as well. Like, and sometimes you feel a bit bad, but making the circle smaller, but wording it the way you just worded it, like putting more value on the actual friendship than the results of the song is a great way to, I've never thought about it like that. I've never thought about it like, you know, do I want to go for a beer afterwards with this person?
Totally.
Or do I just want to run away? That, like, that stuff's really important.
Josh, can I ask a favor? Can I get you to turn your headphones down a little bit? Because those headphones are classic for leaking and I can hear Ethan twice.
Hang on a second. How's that?
Yeah, I think.
Hello. Test. 1-1.
Ethan, way better. That's way better. All right. Thank you, mate. Can you still hear us though, Josh?
Yeah. We're roasting in my ears before.
I think that's the thing. Like, it's, for me, it's like such a personal experience is writing music with people. And I don't mean that in like a hippy dippy way. I know I can sound proper wanky by saying that. But it's like, genuinely, if I'm writing, let's say for instance, like, I don't know your relationship with the Medusa Boys, right? But I'm just using you for an example, and you can tell me if it's completely wrong or not. But, like, you guys have written the record with Medusa. You have some of the biggest records that's happened in the last century, right? In dance music, especially.
Mm.
Like, if that was with somebody that you didn't like, that would suck. Like, I've had it where I've got a very successful record that is not got my name on that I've written, but like one of the writers is an absolute dickhead and I don't want anything to do with that person. I don't really want to talk about that record because there's a relationship that just doesn't feel right. It doesn't sit well with me. And I think there's something about, it's like choosing your partner, like whether your boyfriend or your girlfriend, it's like, is this, it feels very similar to me. I don't know about you guys.
Yeah. I think because when you're also like creatives, we're emotional beings. So when you think of a record, there's so many emotions attached to that record and it can be tainted by stuff, especially when the business end kicks in and everyone's managers are involved. And, you know, even when a record's done and sounding good, you never know which way it's going to go on the politics side of things, and people can really surprise you. And that is such a shame because, yeah, I know me and Josh have songs that that people love, not the Medusa ones, by the way, but there's songs that people love that have come out, and because something really small or something that is slightly frustrating happened in the process, that's kind of it's not based on the music anymore. It's just based on your emotions towards that song. And you know, you might not put it in the set for that reason. And then you're like, why do I not put this song in the set? It's just because, you know, how you feel about it.
But it's the same. And I think there's like also a huge process of working on ourselves for that. And it's like looking into like an ex-partner and going, actually, like, although it ended badly, we had a fucking wicked time during it, right? And it's like, how do you process that? Because especially when the difference between a partner and the music industry is you've got business and money's involved and people get salty around money. I guess it's the same in a partner. Like sometimes, especially with like divorce and stuff, I don't know, I've never been divorced, but like it's very similar. And no one teaches you that.
No. And like, I think kind of our experience of the, and I think a lot of people's experience of the music industry is in the beginning, you're just doing it because you absolutely love it. And you're like muddling through with your mates. You know, like some of the people that we still work with today are like, there's a writer called Connor Blake, was just one of our mates. And we were making music together like before any of this. And then, you know, into this pure like thing, which exists of mates creating art for the love of creating art. Suddenly money is like dumped right in the middle of it. It's like, oh, hang on a minute. We need to like make sure that we can stay mates and try and keep this purity of the pursuit of, you know, the creative pursuit, like you say, without sounding wanky, whilst also trying to put a roof over our heads. And it's quite a delicate balance to like carry out.
How do you balance that as two guys that write together and also two guys that go into a room and write with other people?
That's something that we had to carve out pretty early on, because off the back of PC of Heart, there was just lots of sessions, and me and Josh, like what Josh was saying, really, we were just writing in my bedroom, producing in trying to make really bad dance songs. And then PC Heart happens, and obviously the session quality is elevated and you're put in a lot of really big rooms, and then the demand for both of you is big because Good Boys can be in two different rooms and people are just as stoked about that. And I think the way, just on like a practical level, we'll call certain sessions Good Boys sessions. It's just a really practical way of doing it for the other writers as well. Be like, before, you know, if someone reaches out and they want to do it, and we're like, okay, is it a Good Boys session or we're writing for someone else? And then at least you've had the conversation prior to the session, and then if someone pitches it or whatever, then it's all good. But it works really well because, you know, if I was to put my business Good Boys hat on, you know, let's say Josh is in a session and it's not for Good Boys, but it ends up being wicked and sounding like a Good Boys record, which is, there's a good chance that it would if Josh is in the room, then there's a option for a collaboration, or it gets pitched and it has, you know, we've done some production on it. And then that becomes a conversation of, do we then bring it into our own little blender and work on it as Good Boys? And, you know, that's kind of how it works. But each song has pretty much been different so far. But it just means that we can spread the net a little bit wider, and it opens up way more opportunities for collaborations, because if you're less precious about it, the song can go a bit further, you know?
When did you learn to not be precious about songs? And how did you learn?
I don't know if I don't think I have. I haven't. I massively am the one that's like, no, I know this is a good idea. And I'm the nightmare guy that will do like 1,000 versions with like 10 different people's input. Because I don't know, somebody said to me like early days that like sometimes if it's the right idea, it's better than like making 10 new things. You just got to get the idea right. I think some of our mates like absolutely hate that about us. But I do think that there's obviously some source in learning when to let go of something and not be precious. But I do think there is some source in like holding on and grafting an idea. And I think it's a little bit lost in the modern music world of like, I'm going to do a session every day and I'm going to end at 5 and I'm just going to let a label or a publisher pitch this song. I think there is some like source in just revisiting and grafting it. And like, oh, I mean, a little bit about us, like we came from like the gospel space growing up, writing gospel music. And like, that was the process. You would like work on a song for like 6 months maybe, and like you'd do it on a Sunday and you go, oh, that bit didn't feel right, so you tweak it again. So it's been part of our being like precious has been part of our process, I guess.
No, I really actually really like that concept, because you're right. I think the way, from my experience, like modern dance music is written now, is it is a factory. And I'm not really in the pop world. I've written a few pop things, but like I'm not really in the pop world, and it feels similar in that world. But I can only speak for the dance side. But it feels like just constant release, right release, and just hope that there's some virality on a record that like comes out eventually. I think. Like, just for example, I know this is coming out later on, but like the single, we're recording this in February, but the single that I've just released, that got written in 2022, and it's taken this long to like get to the point where, first of all, a record label even wants it. First of all, we got to a point where we actually are like, yeah, we should probably release this. Second of all, find a record label or multiple record labels that then fight about it, and then one chooses which one gets it. And then you have to A&R it again, because somebody wants to put their two cents in, of course. And then it comes out and you're two years down the line and the records come out, and but it takes time. And I think, but there's also a huge romance about a 30-second idea turns into an absolute massive hit, and it doesn't and it doesn't necessarily need the work.
I think that maybe like combining the two things we've talked about is like a little bit of our process. So like with the Medusa stuff, obviously everyone goes like, oh yeah, this is like amazing moment in Piece of Your Heart that's like whatever. But the truth is, we've made like a whole bunch of other songs with them before that were awful.
Yeah.
You know, like really bad. and a totally different vibe as well. They were like sort of like Kygo vibes, I would say. And I think that there's something about working with the same people and doing a whole load of stuff together. So like say with the Medusa boys, after we've made Piece of Your Heart, which was this like crazy 30-second idea, then you have to follow it up. And you know, we're freaking out going like, well, I don't know, imposter syndrome, I don't know if we can. And actually we did like, I would honestly say about 40 sessions together after that to make the follow-up single. And then, you know, that's kind of been our, like where we've found success is just in writing loads of songs with the same people. So like we've done a whole load of stuff with James Hype as well. And, you know, back in the day before James Hype was what he, you know, the
machine
sort of monolith that he is now. Yeah. We were in James's studio like every night, some weeks like three nights a week until 2 or 3 in the morning, because James would start sessions at 11 at night. And we were working,
who
we were
starts working at 11 o'clock at night?
I know. And we both had full-time jobs at this point as well, so we were like doing it and then like going to work in the morning. But you know, like we made with James and a couple of other mates this tune Ferrari. And you know, we, like I say, we'd done like probably 20 other songs before that, and we made it in 2019, and then it just suddenly comes out in 2021 or 2022 and becomes what it is. But we've, you know, done like, I don't even know how many versions of that song between when we originally had the idea and when it came out, just going, oh, I know it's a good idea, but it's not quite right. Oh, let's try it like this, let's try it like that, let's try it with this person singing, let's try it, you know. So yeah, I guess working a lot with the same people, I think you come up with maybe a different thing than if you are just speed dating, and because you feel more able to suggest like crazy ideas.
I think it's having that confidence in the room with somebody as well, and like knowing that you're not going to offend somebody.
Definitely. Yeah. It's like anything though, like if you were to take it off music and go, you know, for like someone who's doesn't know about songwriting or has never been in a session, you go, oh, how productive is the meeting going to be if you've never met them before?
Yeah.
Or there's like a CEO in the room and you're really nervous to suggest something and you've never met that CEO and you're all brand new, and so everyone's kind of treading on eggshells around each other. Or is it your absolute boys, just like people from your desk, and you're just used to shouting at each other and things can move really quickly because no one's getting offended if the idea is rubbish? Or, do you know what I mean? You can yell at each other. You can be like, good idea, ma'am. We're not putting that in. Do you know what I mean? Like, and no one's offended because you're just like, these guys like me. I know they like me, and I'm not. Whereas if I said that to some, you know, I don't know, some brand new top liner I'd never met before, I'd be like, you know, if you could just sing in key, that would be great. She'd be like, or he'd be like, you can't say that to me. And you can't, you really can't. But we can to our friends. So, you know, that's yeah. Why it's productive.
It's funny that. Because it's like how I feel like there's always a time in a session where the ice breaks and you take that risk of saying something that you know you're not too sure if it's either going to go two ways. It's either going to be like they're going to fucking hate you and they're just going to like suck up and be like, oh, I have to leave at 5 o'clock. Or they're going to be like, you're a dickhead, but you're so right.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, and those are the big deep breath moments where you can be like, ah,
we
great.
Got there. Yeah,
this is going to be easy. Like this is
So
I
go on, Josh, carry on.
No, we were doing a session last week with a guy and two girls, and we knew one of them didn't know the other one. And about, like you say, like 2 hours into the session, the guy made a dick joke and we all just sort of stopped and looked at each other and were like, is this okay? And then everyone laughed and were like, okay, cool. And it kind of, it like relaxed everybody into it. But for a second it was like, oh, hang on.
It's also,
I want to stress that the guy wasn't me. I didn't make that.
No, it wasn't Ethan. It wasn't Ethan.
It's always really interesting, especially like, It's actually really scary, and I don't like it because I feel like not everyone, but most of us are all coming from the kindest side of our hearts, if you know what I mean, when having a laugh in the studio or just having a laugh in life. We're all generally nice people. But again, you can offend people and people can be offended. 100%. And also, this industry is so small that like you offend one person without even knowing you're going to offend them. That word can get around so fucking quickly, and it's really scary. And I've found myself in studios where I'm just like, how do I crack this? How do I like get over that first initial relationship? Because I don't want to offend somebody, but also like, I just don't know. So I have to almost like be blunt and just ask and just go up, be upfront with them. And because I think it's like, realistically it is business, and it's the case of writing a great record. And if we can break that barrier to start with, then let's crack on.
And I don't think loads of people talk about like, to your point, I don't think loads of people, it's not really something that you would like learn at music school, like how to be sociable, but do you know, it's so integral to a session, but like, you wouldn't spend loads of time like learning about it. You have to like learn social cues in like a tiny box room that you're put in and told to write a song. It's like some of the best producers we've ever worked with are just amazing at making you feel great.
Yeah.
And that feels like such a large chunk of why the song ends up being good. And like what we were saying about being feeling a certain way towards a record, there's producing like on the tools on the desk, and then there's like producing the room and like some of the big boys in, you know, like in LA and America, they're just like, you meet them in person and they're just amazing. They just make you feel amazing.
Yeah.
And it's like, there's almost a science to producing an artist. Like if you're in a room with an artist and you're gassing them up, they're going to write
the best
awesome
shit.
Stuff. Do you know what I mean? And you're talking to them about, if you spend an hour talking to them about their life before they have to sing an emotional song into, do you know what I mean? There's like, there's producing people, which is a whole other thing.
That you're 100%, yeah, you're 100% right. I remember listening to the Rick Rubin, I think it was a Rick Rubin and James Blake podcast. And it was just after Rick had produced his, not his last album, but the album before, the like super emotional album.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was like, James was like, yeah, I came to the ranch and was like, played you all this music, and you were like, it's good, but you can do better.
Mad.
Like, you can do, wow, like, way better. And then they then just spent a month of pretty much just doing therapy between themselves.
Yeah, mad.
And just, like, yeah, opening up to each other. And, like, and I don't know how much Rick does in the studio. Like, I don't think he necessarily does that much. Like, in a sense of actually on the tools or actually songwriting or actually just like engine, whatever. But that then, the process of how he spent the time with him, let his wife come over, like did all of this and just kind of made him feel at home and comfortable to be able to open up, to like unlock another level of artistry, which then allowed him to then write another album that was just amazing. The process is special.
And the role of the producers sort of like changed over time as well, because now if you're a producer in a room, because of, you know, everybody's got access to Logic and Ableton or Fruity Loops or whatever it is you might use, you know, the producer is the engineer now. But like, I don't know if you've watched the Beatles, you know, that extended documentary. Mm. I loved watching the producers who are involved in that, because there's an engineer in the room who's sort of doing what we would now describe as the producer role.
Yeah.
You know, they're the one recording, editing, comping the takes and stuff. But the producer is the person in the room going, oh, try it like this. Oh, can you, what if you put this fill there? They're actually sort of the glue. And I don't know, I feel like that's something that we've sort of lost a little bit.
I'm trying to bring it back. That's my goal, is to try and bring it back, because I'm fucking not that talented in the studio, but I can talk a good game.
But the bridging the gap is difficult, because you still need to know how to use the doors, and they need to know how to the phrases. I think it's hard when you've got an engineer who, or you know, like a junior producer or something, is in the session, he doesn't know what you're asking them to do. Yeah. It's like, you still need to be able to articulate it. But yeah, I think there is an in-between gap, which sometimes the vibe falls through that gap of, we've got like a really talented, producer, but he's not said a word.
Yeah.
And, do you know what I mean? Because he's nervous, or do you know what I mean? Whatever. It's like, and then the vibe kind of dissipates.
how do you guys, with the relationship between both of you, how does it work in a sense of that? Because I've recently worked on a project myself that's been a year-long project, and although I've been writing sessions for myself with lots of other people, but then I've been coming back into my studio working with somebody else on those specific records. And just the relationship between me and, his name's Mitch Jones, like me and him, like his made, it's completely changed how I've looked at producing, and also like the concept of writing a record, and also the ability, like it just adds so much more diversity to the session. But I don't think I would have been able to get that if it was just like a one-off session.
I think that part of it is like having to agree that an idea is good, I think changes the dynamic. So like, everybody thinks their own ideas are good, obviously. So I think that having somebody else, like whoever it is, if you trust that each other have like the best intentions for the song or the project as sort of like a given, then, you know, it's actually great working with other people and working with somebody else like Ethan with a shared goal, because otherwise I think both of us would go on a completely different tangent, or you lose sort of sight of what it is you're trying to make. Or I'm probably a bit more emotional in what I want to do with songs, whereas Ethan's like very focused on keeping it with universal appeal. So I think that it works nicely because we sort of balance each other out. And even not just music, in a project, like if I'm angry at somebody who we're, you know, working with or doing a deal with, or, you know, management or whatever, chances are Ethan isn't, and vice versa. So you can sort of find your center somehow.
Yeah. And I think the amount of times that I've been fuming and Josh is like, nah, it's not that bad. And then likewise, Josh will be really angry at something and I'll be like, nah, I went through that the other day. It's not that bad. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, and then, you know, you're kind of like, whereas if you were left to your own devices, you'd just probably spiral a little bit. And you do, like Josh said, there's a centering of like, and I think even on the collaborative sense, it's like, I try my best to have like a being a reasonable filter. Like, am I being unreasonable? So like, before I like interject, or before my like emotions just go, no, I think I'm right, I try and run everything through like a filter of, am I actually just fighting for my idea?
Yeah.
Or is that idea better? And I think once you remove your emotions from the kind of almost like competitiveness of fighting or like wanting your idea to be there, you become a lot more like subjective. You just become like, is it like the end goal is the benefit of the song? Great. Is this better for the song, or am I just trying to get my idea? And then, you know, you sit with it for a day or so and you go, actually, I think it's better. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? And whereas if you just e-jerk react to stuff, which I'm very guilty of, I do all the time, but I'm trying to get better at that stuff.
It's a process, right? It takes time. But I think having each other allows the process to kind of run a little bit smoother. And also you guys know each other better than anybody else that's going to be in the room with you. So you guys can be completely honest with each other at the same time, which I think is very helpful when writing records, especially nowadays when it is about getting shit out as quickly as possible.
Yeah. It's a bit like a marriage, me and Ethan, because, you know, we're traveling constantly. Like, often we've, maybe more in the past, but we've shared rooms, and you spend like all of your time with this other person. So yeah, you can't really read each other's mind.
Yeah, you can. That's what I was exactly what I was about to say. Like, you can. I know that someone's going to say something in a session, and I know that, you know, me and Josh will kind of like cowboy eye each other as if to be like, are you going to take this one or shall I? Because it might be, you know, if it's in the session for a Good Boys thing, it might be something that we wouldn't write about.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're both like Josh said, like kind of reading each other's minds to be like, we probably wouldn't do that. Do you know what I mean? But like, we're both on the same thing, and you only get that with literally 5 years of touring and sharing bedrooms and just sat next to each other on a plane and sharing music. And like, I remember like we were probably about 3 years in to Good Boys and had done a bunch of stuff, like, you know, Piece of Heart's out, Lose Control's out, all these other records are out, we're touring, and we both realized that we loved like old kind of early rave records, like early Boys Noise kind of like Fake Blood, you know, all that type of stuff.
Days.
Yeah. And we never spoke about it, and it was literally like we didn't know, and Josh was like, oh yeah, I've got all these CDs that I like, and so we, you know, referencing all these sounds and stuff, but it's like we spent like 3 years not even knowing that the other person like even listened to it or knew about it. Do you know what I mean? So it's like quite fun. All that stuff.
That's so dope. It's just nice being able to get to know. It sounds really, really airy fairy, but just like being able to build a relationship with somebody where you can just like, they're just your mates, and there's nothing better than doing shit with your mates. It's just makes it fun.
Yeah,
Even if you hate each other, even if you hate each other, like on days, like you wake up and you hate each other and you piss each other off, but you just know that they're always going to be your mate. That's what it's about.
Yeah, yeah.
We kind of had this. We've fallen into that kind of relationship with I don't know. I think you know Biscuits.
Yeah.
He's like another, for people that don't know, he's another DJ from the UK. He's an insane producer. But we met him once in the studio. We were put in the studio together, and it was just the funniest 5 hours of my life.
I love that.
And like, we're all just sort of slightly awkward, slightly introverted, like creative dudes. And it just, I don't know, we were all on the same wavelength. And now we have sort of loved spending time with each other so much. We've done like, I don't even know how many songs. We've done like a full US tour together. We're about to do European versions of the same sort of back-to-back tour. Mm. But like you say, it's just because we just like hanging out. And that's literally where the tour came from and where the stuff came from, is because we were like, yeah, we just really like each other.
So important.
The vibes are high.
It's so important. Yeah. I think it can be lost so easily in business, right? It, like, managers get involved, agents get involved, and they like pay you with like, oh, go do this, go do that. Like, this is gonna sell well if you do that. Like, I know I've had the conversation with my manager. My manager's like, oh, can you go on tour with this person? And I'm just like, he was like, it would sell really well, and I'm like, yeah, I know, but I just get a weird feeling from them, so no. Yeah. Like, it's just,
no, genuinely.
But like, if I could take one of my best mates, or that's like maybe like not as successful, if you know what I mean, we wouldn't sell as many tickets, or but it would be so much fun, but maybe not make as much money. Like, that sounds way more appealing to me, if I'm honest.
And I think the people who come to the events and who see stuff online, they can tell when there's a good vibe and when it's a genuine friendship.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that people appreciate and sort of can connect with, rather than, you know, some of these collaborations, I'm not going to name anyone, but sometimes you see these collaborations, it feels like sterile. A label has gone 1 + 1 = mega hit.
Yeah.
And it's like, I don't think these people have even met before. No. They've like, the Sausage Factory machine has just pushed it through.
Yeah, I'm sure you know people, but I've had a call from somebody, from one of my mates, can't name names, but he's like, dude, this was done in his session and he wasn't even in the room, and it's now my single and now he's put his name on the record. And like, yes, it made it a mega hit, but like... It's just not authentic. However, we're in the music business, and record labels need to make money.
Yeah, 100%. And once you have, like, you get so much peace from when you, like what you just said, like, you get so much peace whenever you like think about it like that.
Yeah.
Because if you actually just articulate it in your mind, like, to an extent, they're a business and they need to make money.
Totally.
Then you're like, you know, you get so frustrated at certain things because it's not like creative, or it's not like, you're like, you know, you're questioning certain things as to whether that's like, it, you know, it doesn't feel right. And then you're like, there is a business side to things.
Yeah.
Like, I get, you know, fair. Do you know what I mean? And then you just, you kind of chills you out a little bit. At least me anyway. Like, I got crazy. Yeah.
So talking about business, you guys have had extreme success, like, from what most people would even dream of. How much pressure does that put on you guys every time you release a record? Because I'm not stupid in thinking that that's an easy process to kind of go through, especially from the first big record that everybody knew was Piece of Your Heart, right? Like, and I'll be honest, like, I wasn't aware of you guys before that. I know you were doing stuff before that, but I wasn't aware of you. So, like, how is the pressure still there? And how was that pressure initially?
I mean, initially it was a nightmare, to be honest. I know it sounds like champagne problems, and it definitely was champagne problems, but the first song had become, that Piece of Your Heart had become such a sort of success that there was so much pressure to follow it up. And we, like I kind of said before about imposter syndrome, you just feel like it was a fluke. I don't think I can ever do it again.
Yeah.
And then, you know, they suddenly put us in with all these, like Ethan was saying, sort of A-list writers. And then you feel like, oh, none of my ideas are going to be as good as these people's ideas. And then I think I would still say to a degree now, you know, we're five or six years into this and we've had like a reasonable number of songs we've been involved in, like do quite well. I have like some degree of confidence that, oh, sometimes I do have good ideas. But even so, when we go into a session and somebody brings up like, you know, some of the songs you've done that are successful, it puts a massive pressure on your shoulders because it's like, cool, so is that what you're expecting from today? This, you know, mega hit song, or I don't know. And I think it puts this weird dynamic in the session where sometimes, for me anyway, my process is I like to try 100 ideas and then decide which one is the best.
Yeah.
And sometimes if you go into a session and you've done something that's done well recently, you might suggest something and then people in the room go, yep, that's it. And you're like, oh, hang on a minute, I don't even know if that's it. I'm just, that's just the first thing that's come out of my mouth. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's been weird and definitely very high pressure.
And I think as well, like, it's, I don't know if poison chalice is the right phrase. Josh, you'd probably know that's a ye old phrase. Is that what I'm trying to say? Poison chalice. Yeah. It's like, but to give context. I've started a thing now.
So good.
To give context is like, so yeah, you do those records and it's fine. And then you, like you say, you've got to build your own project. And then that becomes like, oh, well, you're involved in those records, so now your project will be just as big. And you spend most of your time trying to convince people that's probably not the case. Yeah. Like, and you put so much pressure on chasing hits and trying to be algorithmic. And then you go too algorithmic and that sucks a lot of the joy out of it, or like the sauce out of the song, because it sounds algorithmic and it sounds like you're trying to repeat tricks. And I think then you go down the wormhole of, well, the reason that song was amazing and worked is because it was different. So then you've had a taste of being a part of a record that changes something. So you don't chase the same record, you chase the feeling of being part of something that changes something.
Yeah,
if that makes sense. And then that becomes a really weird headspace to be in, because no one wants to do sessions with you because you sound like a mental person, because you're like, let's do, like, you know, you're chasing the new thing, so it sounds nothing like what they want to write. Your head is like, I'm currently going in the direction of like mentalness, because that's what we had success from last time. And then you kind of, you know, I think all these years on, we've found a nice middle ground, which is like, there are certain rules and there are certain sonics and there are certain things that we like to stick to, and there are certain things we know people like, and then there is margin for like doing mental stuff.
Yeah.
And I think that's where we want to live, but it isn't like we're out here whipping ourselves every time a song doesn't get like a billion streams, because you'll just go insane. So throughout like lockdown, and me and Josh just like having just long like chats and good conversations with each other, it's like, it's about creating bodies of work. It's about nurturing a fan base. It's about solidifying like your touring and your place in the market. And so much of existing as a DJ in today's like modern DJ world is just about surviving, like, to an extent. If you can survive for like 15 years through just the chaos, then you'll probably be doing really well by like that 10-year mark. Do you know what I mean? Like, you'll probably be quite up there, but it's just so hard to survive, and it's so hard to keep your finger on the pulse. And so that's kind of like where we're at, where we set our, in the middle of setting really long-term goals, instead of, right, next year we need a hit. It's like, no, in 10 years I'd love to do this.
Yeah.
And how do we put things in place so that we can get there? And that takes a lot of pressure off the session. It takes a lot of pressure off like our relationship. It takes a lot of pressure off like just your own personal life where you're like beating yourself down trying to get this next thing, and you're just like, oh, actually the goal is long term, and the goal is to be paid to knob around with my mates and do music. That's like actually the dream. Do you know what I mean? Like knobbing around in a hotel room with biscuits in Denver.
Yeah.
And you're all on salary to do it. It's great. It's like, that's the goal.
So I want to dig deeper into that, because I genuinely love that. And I think nobody is talking about that nowadays. Like, nobody is talking about the long game. And because I think we're in that world of virality and needing to have a hit straight away. Like, and for anybody listening, I'm sorry, I hooted and hollered about this for so long, but like, I've never had a hit record. I've had big records. I've never had a hit record. And don't get me wrong, every day I wake up and go, fuck me, I wish I had a hit record right now. But like, I think realistically, I'm 10 years now full time as a DJ, and I still haven't had a hit record. And for me, there comes a point in my career where, especially now, where I'd like, I think a hit record would actually really help me in a sense of, I'm not the new kid on the block. Mm-hmm. I have been around and done lots of things, and I've had an extremely successful career. I'm very fortunate and extremely happy with what I've done. However, I've nowhere near reached my goal of where I want to be. But again, sitting back and reflecting, I've got another 10 years of this. I got another 20 years of this. I got another 30 years of this. Like, we're all still young guys, right? Mm. And I look at the people that have been around for that long, and there's not many, because a lot of people just stop, right? Because I feel like life changes. People aren't willing to put the work in as what they did. Everything changes. But I guess I kind of want to go more in detail with you of like, what is, like, how do you work that 10-year goal, and how do you kind of bring that back? Because we can all have a pipe dream goal, right? We can all have that goal, what you said, I just want to fuck around with mates in a hotel room and get paid for it, right? Mm-hmm. Technically, you're doing that now, but which is fucking cool. But how do you go, okay, in 10 years' time, I still want to be doing this. What do I need to do to get there?
Yeah.
And do you guys set goals for that? Do you work that out? How do you kind of get to that point?
Well, to your point, well, like, I just separate from this, we've spoken about this before. I know we mentioned it on the cruise ship. We spoke about this. We don't talk about the cruise. but I remember you said the same thing, and I remember thinking something at the time, which I never really mentioned, but to your point about you having success now 10 years in, like, if you were to have a quote unquote mega hit, you have so much infrastructure in place that there is almost like fertile ground for the hit to land and be fruitful. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, you'd be able to jump on tour, you'd be able to handle more shows, you'd be able to do this, you'd be able to do that. And it would be, whereas I think when we were part of the first song, there was zero infrastructure in place. And sometimes I'm really glad that it was Medusa leading the charge on the single, because we had such little infrastructure in place that, like, having to go to like the Grammys and having to get a booker, and what's your logo? We don't have a logo. Great.
Make accountants, you know what I mean? like accountants, lawyers, like all of the boring stuff.
Sheer chaos. Don't have publishers, don't have a label, like just chaos. And then trying to tour, and like, there was not, it wasn't a very, it wasn't very fertile ground for it to land. And I'm really happy that it wasn't just like a Good Boy song. It was like, you know, we were able to plan a little bit, because a lot of it was like Medusa leading the charge. So I think now we go into a place like what you said, where it's like we're building, and there is infrastructure in place, luckily. And we kind of have to I don't know if we probably should set goals. I don't know if we do, Josh, to be honest. But we have long term plans.
No, you can be honest. We every year at the start of the year we have a whiteboard and we sit with the whiteboard and we plan what we want to do for the year. I've still got the whiteboard of this year's one like up in the house, and kind of where we want to be musically throughout the year by the end of the year. What kind of artists we want to be aligned with show-wise, release-wise, those kind of things. Because, you know, with the music industry, you've got to work like 6 months out, essentially.
Yeah.
So, because you've got to make the records, get the collaboration signed off, get in the studio, 6 weeks lead time, 8 weeks lead time, you know, it's like sort of 6 months out. There is sort of some intentionality to it, I think.
Yeah, definitely. And we have a little side list of people whose music we like. And Will's on the board, but he knows that. He knows he's...
But you know what?
I reckon... being intentional about collaborations.
Totally.
But I think
which
that's
I didn't force. we're on record. Will asked us for the session.
I asked you lot.
So, yeah.
No, we would have asked. I think we were just too nervous to ask.
Never be too nervous.
Yeah.
No, I
think that...
Go on, Josh.
No, I think being part of the culture is, like, part of it as well. Mm. So, like, obviously, Will, you're such a part of the scene around your music and your label is that there is longevity because, you know, even... Like, I know we were joking about, like, blogosphere dance days before, but that is... We were all, like, part of that and we've been music lovers since then and so we're so deep in the scene now. Me and Ethan sometimes joke, we're like, oh, yeah, that song's rinsed, that song's done, and it's actually not even out. It's just everybody that we know has been playing it. It's not done. Yeah. It's not rinsed. But I think that because you're, like... Because you're in the scene and you're in the clubs, you're at the festivals, like, you know what is coming next and... I think that's how you have sort of longevity because you develop this sort of like foresight that the guys who are, and I'm not slating them because, you know, some of these people are my best friends, but the guys who are just in sessions day in, day out, like in the studio, that listen to music once it's released, but they're never in the clubs.
Yeah.
You know, they're not listening to like demos that are sent to labels. They're not artists. So they're not getting sent demos from people. They don't know what is like the swell and what's the next thing.
Yeah.
And I think that is where like the magic and the huge sort of breakthrough moments come from, is like tapping into what is going to be the next thing and it just hitting at the right time as that thing comes in.
I think it's also, I totally agree. I think it's also for me is about like with you, you guys must have had it with the Medusa records. It's like everyone just tries to copy.
Yeah.
And for me, copying just really isn't something that you can create.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
A career around. Like, you guys have a sound and that's... Good Boys, right? No one else can be Good Boys. No one else can make a record. They can make a record that sounds similar, but it's never going to be a Good Boys record. So the thing that I really struggle with is the difference between taking inspiration and copying. And I think we're talking about the, like, it's very fine. It's a very fine tuning, but in the commercial world, and I'm not too sure how you guys must come across it a lot more than well, no, it happens in like the underground scene as well, massively. But it's like, yeah, there's somebody sees success in a record and goes, I need to do that because that's what's successful. However, yeah, that isn't success.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was only successful because it was a new thing.
Exactly.
And now it's not, the minute you replicate it, it's not a new thing anymore.
Yeah.
Sorry, John.
And the joy of creating and writing and like the point, I know this sounds so like, you know, whimsical, but the point of making music is like coming up with new ideas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And like, I guess there's, that's sort of the business versus the art side, isn't it? It's like, if you're in it for a business, then yeah, there's a business to be had in just hopping on every trend and recreating, you know, recreating. That's probably the distinction, recreating rather than creating something new.
Yeah.
And I guess it depends on your approach. But for me, anyway, the joy is in trying to come up with a new idea.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think if the approach is, I'm referencing it because I think it's sick and it excites me, and I heard it before everyone else heard it, I was gassed, and like, I genuinely am a huge fan of the song, so I want to reference this thing from it because I liked it, as opposed to, that's been successful, and so I'm going to copy it because it's an algorithm. And I think the way to know that you're not doing that is you're referencing songs that have 5,000 streams on it as well,
yeah,
and going, that really excites me, I'm going to reference that thing from that song, yeah, because not, there's no success to it, it's not a successful record at all. And that's something that we try and do lots of. It's not that that's not successful, obviously that is success because they're probably touring loads by releasing those records, but the thing that we try and do, especially if we're in a mainstream session, I don't know if that's the right word, but if we're trying to write something that might cross over, we are bringing to the session songs that we play live that they probably haven't heard of. Some of these, you know, like pop writers, we're trying to play really niche things that don't have any success,
yeah,
and we're trying to play them, and we're trying to reference sounds that really excite us sonically and that we know work live, and then pair them with, you know, some, maybe some mainstream things and some and like hooky songwriting tactics and all that sort of stuff. It's great, but I think there's a really exciting synergy when you put the two together, and it also helps you from going insane by going, I'm gonna use the exact same bass noise as the thing that's in the charts,
yeah,
and you're like, well, why? Because it's done now, it's out there, it's in the world.
There's been a couple times in the past few years where I've heard that. Once, that was when you guys did the Medusa records, and then secondly, recently with Calvin and Eddie Golden, and you're just like, it's all I hear now. And also in the underground scene is like hard techno. I get sent so many demos for the record label, just fucking really hard techno, and I'm like, go listen to what I'm releasing. Go listen to what I play. I don't play this. I've never played this in my life. So like, please don't send it to me. But that, I think that's the where we kind of cross the business and the passion. Because I think kids are doing, not just kids, that's really condescending of me, but people that just, they think that they have to copy to have success. It's the actual really weird things that come through that doesn't sound like anything else that actually are the success.
And there's a lot of scaremongering from, like, not scaremongering, but like, there's a lot of pressure from labels to be like, that needs to, oh, that's good, we should make something that sounds like that. And if you're actually in the session, you're there going, I don't really want, like, you know, how many times have you been told to reference Fred again in the last 2 years? It's like, I just can't, if I hear Fred again, I just turn my brain off. Because there's no point. He's so good at what he does.
Yeah.
And he's really good at being himself. So he's probably the best at being Fred again, because he is Fred again. Do you know what I mean? We're the best at being good boys, because if someone sends me a good boy song, which they do all the time, like on DM or send to Dropbox link or whatever, it's a fully finished song with someone who sounds like Josh singing a song, and it's fine. They go, hey man, I've made this for you. And I go, sick man. well, you've made a Good Boys song. It sounds like a Good Boys song, but we didn't write it, we didn't make it. So why? It's finished. So,
and it's not as good.
Yeah, well, maybe sometimes they're great, but it's not as good.
It's the fact, because it's like, then it's not as good because it's not come from you.
Exactly, yeah. And if we wanted to make that song, we could sit down and make that song, because we are us.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
and you should go and find out, you know, kid who sent the link, who you are.
Yeah.
Because you've made a song that sounds like us, and that's great if it's a pitch song. But if you're trying to do the artist thing, you need to go and find out what you want to tell people.
So talking about that process of finding who you are, how did you guys find who you were? Was it the case of having the hit record that then was like, oh, actually, this, we've been doing this for a while and now it seems to work? Or is it just a case of working together? Like, how did you guys find
it? It took ages.
No, it's taken ages. And I think we're only getting there now, to be honest. Like, obviously we had those big moments. And then we also had some other big moments that, like, we just don't talk about anymore now, because we're like, oh, I wish we hadn't done that. You know, like, basically doing everything that we've just preached about not doing, we did. About, like, you know, like jumping on a trend or, like... But it's because we've learned through, like, making our own mistake, basically.
It's the only way. But I guess the issue... Yeah. Not the issue. There's no issue in any of this. But the thing is the mistakes that you guys have felt are mistakes have been so successful it's just so out there, right?
Yeah, I mean,
if you were to look through our discography, you would see that we're absolute silly gooses and we just do stupid shit every now and then. Like, it's pretty cohesive, and then it's just one thing. It just makes no sense. And then if you go into the studio with us for like a day, they'd go, oh no, that makes sense. Like, you're nailing it. Stupid idea, shouldn't have done it. Nailing it. That's kind of the rhythm.
Yeah, and we kind of, you know, like, we're the guys that will do something for a joke and then it sort of gets out of hand. But I genuinely think, like, you know, the thing about second album syndrome.
Yeah.
So, like, if a band has been, like, playing together for 5 or 6 years, they've been touring these songs, they get the songs sounding, feeling great, they work in a live setting, then they record them, they make their first album. You know, it's amazing. It wins all these awards. And then a year later, they release a second album and it's crap. It's like, well, yeah, because they've not done like 6 years of touring and refining and working on their sound. I think that when we started, we hadn't done the 6 years, basically. Yeah. Mm. And I think now we've done, 6 years of touring and doing shows, and what do we like and what kind of sound do we like to play? And I think our live sets now are a very, like, we've got a sound, and obviously sometimes you have to be more commercial than you might like to. Sometimes you can go a bit more underground, but, you know, I think we've found a sound, and we've been doing these like linked sort of online, I don't know, sets. And I think that is the sound that we want to play, and that's the sound we want to do. And it's the first time where we've looked at something and gone like, oh, we found our sound, and like, we're happy with it, we're proud of it. It's locked.
Yeah. And it took a while as well, as the other thing. Like, I think people like take the example of someone having chart success because their song's gone viral.
Yeah.
The amount of times that me and Josh get brought in, either from a label or from whoever, from management or publishing, whatever, to help write some kind of follow-up, just as everyone else is kind of getting drafted in to help. It's like, all hands on deck, this person didn't know they were gonna have a hit, let's help them try and write another one. The amount of times that, because of, there's this like virality to songs now, the amount of times there isn't infrastructure in place or a project in place, or even, like, sounds like horrible, but I say it from a place of like being in a similar place, there's no real artist there, and they haven't figured out who they are.
Yeah.
So you're trying to write a follow-up for them, and as you're talking to them, you're like, so that, you know what I mean, they can't tell you who they are and they can't tell you what they want to be. And that's a really and I only say that quite freely because I've been in that place, and me and Josh have been there. So it's kind of like, okay, well, you need to go away and figure out what you want to be. And you're on, by the way, you just had a hit. So you're on like the clock now.
Yeah, timer.
And that's a tough place to be. And I think we've had to watch people come into the charts or have huge success and not follow it up. And in order to see that, like, that's not a sustainable thing to do, like what you were saying, like 10 years in, have a hit 100%, don't follow up, doesn't matter. I've got a fan base.
Yeah.
I've got all this stuff in place. Whereas if you're having a hit and you've not got this narrative you want to tell people, like I was saying to my friend the other day, like, everyone and their mum's a DJ now. Like, yeah, it just is how it is. And that's great. There's probably more DJs than there are artist projects, mm-hmm, by quite a considerable amount, I would argue.
Yeah.
And I think if you want to start releasing records, you need to also, because it's 2024, it's more than just music now. People want, like, fans want meat on the bone. They want to be able to buy into a project.
Yeah.
And if you're not ready to tell people something when you release a record, then you're almost setting yourself up. You're risking failure because people want to know about it and they want to listen to more records and they want to go back and listen to your discography. It's, yeah, like, there's sometimes not anything there to listen to. And that's what, and I'm only saying that because that's what we've had to go and do and go, right, what are we trying to tell? Like, we know who we are now, but like, we've had to go away and figure it out. Yeah. And be authentic.
That's the fun bit though. I think when you sit back and look at it, and I know, like, during it, and I've not been in the situation where you guys are at, but like, I can imagine the pressure during that situation of like trying to figure out can be really demoralizing. I've been in situations where, like, okay, fire my management, leave the record label that I'm known for, go try and go into a different world that's just like so not what I'm known for. But then, and you realize how shit it is, that process. Yet when you reach those little targets and those little goals, how happy it makes you feel and how you realize that you're actually on the right track. And then when you get to the point where you're like, yeah, I'm there, but then the artist kicks in and you're like, okay, what's next?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, 100%.
Which is a killer.
It's a long journey.
I want to talk about record labels because, Ethan, I know when we were on ship and Josh was, I don't know what Josh was doing, but we were behind.
You don't want to know. Oh, honestly.
You definitely weren't sleeping. You definitely weren't sleeping. We were watching you on stage. but we spoke about, like, quite candidly, like, the power kind of struggle between, or the dynamic between artist and record label, and artist and A&R. And I think going from where you guys were at, where what happens generally a lot of times is, and tell me if you feel I'm wrong in saying this, but an artist has a bit of success and then a record label comes on board and is like, you need to do this, this, and this, right? But you guys had huge, like, success that nobody could ever think of as quite early on in your career. How does that change the dynamic between you and the label?
Yeah. Well, I think that in an ideal situation, kind of what we're saying, like, back in the day, labels used to, like, build artists.
Yeah.
And they would, like, create an artist project with them and they'd invest in them over a long period. And now the dynamic has shifted because of things like TikTok, where labels try, or major labels, maybe I should say, try and sign things that are already moving,
yeah,
that are like a guaranteed win. And, you know, it's like Ethan's point before, it's a business. So, like, you know, you have to understand that these people's bonuses are based on them signing certain things. And I don't have any problem with that. That's like any job. But then, you know, we, like many artists, I think we've found ourselves stuck in a position sometimes where, you know, the label are paying X amount for a song, so they're like, we need this to be a hit. So then, but you're like, well, nobody knows what's going to be a hit, and to a certain degree, if you invest enough into the marketing of it, it will be a hit.
Yeah,
you know that. So there's like a chicken and egg, and it's really difficult balance to strike between wanting to create something, do something new, push the boat, which ultimately is where the hit will be found. But then the labels are obviously looking for security in what is an investment into you. So we, you know, we know people, and we've looked at doing similar things with ourselves, like restructuring deals so that you can release more music.
Yeah.
And instead of just like having this one flagpole moment, it's like, you know, all of our chances are on this one song, which even just mathematically isn't a good idea. You know, you'd spread bet, right? I think that that's just been an interesting dynamic for us to work out, and we've arrived at the conclusion that it's, we don't want to chase this one big single and then as soon as you've released it and it does well, you're back into the rat race of, oh my goodness, stress, we need to write another hit single. You know, that it's horrible. Versus we want to make the music that we love to make and people seem to enjoy and then build it up that way.
Like the success rate for people who have been dropped in right at the deep end and have signed a massive deal and there's loads of pressure versus someone who has climbed through indie labels and or starting a movement or is part of a culture that's growing. I read something the other day which was sick. Someone posted it and it was something along the lines of, there is a movement growing right now that I know nothing about that is really cool and I hate, I'll probably hate it if I hear it, and they're probably having the most amount of fun.
That was DVS
One. I'm going to hear about it.
DVS1.
Yeah, what was that? I probably absolutely butchered it.
But no, you're right. So, and it was like they're probably wearing something that I think is fucking gross, but it's they're loving it. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, and I think that the success rate of doing that versus being hyped about to death and then dropped in this huge deal, which does work because obviously it's a business. If they're invested, they're going to need to make their investment back. So they're going to keep putting resources into you and all that's great, but I would err on the side of caution. And like what we were saying about building the project is you can arrive at that at the like top of the stairs, so to speak. You can sign to a club label, release some club music, you can withhold maybe some of your more like popular ideas because you don't have access to a major label yet, and then you can start to release like, and you can build your own like silo of culture, and then as you kind of get traction, and these A&Rs, like, they're not silly, like they're on SoundCloud, they're on every, like they've heard your music, definitely they've heard everyone's music because they're, that's what their job is. And it's funny when people are like, I just can't get my music to these majors. I'm like, no, they've heard it. So it's kind of like it's just not good.
unless it's nowadays, it's no, they haven't heard it because you're not on TikTok.
Yeah. You don't have a jillion followers on TikTok. Yeah, they've heard it. It is good. You don't have a social media presence. but you could arrive at and I wish, you know, I don't have any regrets, but that would be something that I would love to have done, where you build to the big, because then an A&R knows exactly what they're signing, they know exactly what the culture is, they can see the project, and then they know what it looks like going forward, as opposed to together we're going to have to build and somewhat fabricate this project together. And that does work, but it's harder for any, because then there's more work for the A&R and blah, blah, and the label, and they're helping you discover who you are.
Yeah.
Whereas if you turn up and you've got like a relatively small fan base and movement, then they're going to sign it because they're going to be like, I get it. I know exactly what it sounds like. I know exactly what the first song is going to sound like. And the chances are they're not going to bet loads of money on the first one doing well. Yeah. They're going to go, I'll sign it for whatever. And then and those are the records that do well. Like, I think some label, like, yes, there are some major labels that I really like for like being a part of the culture and signing stuff where there's a groundswell and then it does well. And you're like, yeah, that's how it should be, really. Like, that makes me feel like this.
I think I totally agree. I think there's some major indies that do really well as well. Like, let's say, for instance, your Ninja Tunes. Like, I know XL is a major kind of because they sign Adele. But like XL is like a great concept as well for me. Is like you don't really hear much about them, but they release really great stuff and they work it. They work it so well that like one record out of an album might not do well. Two records out of an album might not do well, but an album will do well. And I think like I had a conversation with Dot from London Grammar on the podcast. And I don't think he actually said it on the podcast, but I spoke to him and he's like, as London Grammar, as the band, they've never had a quintessential hit record, but they've had a hit that every album's done like number one.
Yeah, exactly.
And every record on the album, because they've built their fan base, everything that they've done does well because their fan base is so important to them. And I think that's the value in the long term. However, there does come a point when your fan base gets old. And it sounds really like disrespectful, but you, like, let's say, for instance, you're John Summits now. His fan base is so young. However, in 10 years' time, John Summits' fan base is going to be 10 years older. They're all probably going to be having kids and settling down and not going to rave. So it's like, how do you keep that fan base young? Which is another conversation on branding and reinventing yourself and keeping relevant. It's a tough one, that, as well.
Yeah,
definitely.
Yeah, I have no idea.
and I think that's where a lot of the like what you're saying about labels, a lot of the, there is a shift that's probably happening in dance music, which is like people are protecting their livelihoods almost to an extent. I think they're going, great, okay, well, I need to nurture this fan base and I need my, you know, I want to be able to drop a pin somewhere in the world and sell tickets. So what does that look like without a global hit? Because the chances are, even if you have a global hit, they're going to know the song and not you. So do you want to sell hard tickets in Sydney? And do you want to sell hard tickets in Germany?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And then what does that look like? And, you know, that you can have three massive hits in a row and still people might not know who you are if you don't have this huge infrastructure of pictures of your face and radio interviews and billboards and just blasting people with like who you are. Like, you could low-key be like huge successful and, you know, not sell anything.
It's so weird, isn't it, how especially it's weird how especially nowadays that you can have hit records and not sell tickets, where it used to be like you'd have hit records and because radio stations and that's all people would listen to, everyone would know who you are. I feel like there was a lot less hit records and now there's way more niches of to have hit records in. But I think that is the hard thing as well. And on a financial situation, although you can still earn very good money from streams and making music and writing and being on cuts and publishing deals and record deals and things like that, the majority of most artists make their money from the live aspect.
100%.
And I think that's also what a lot of people don't realize, is like building a fan base is the hardest bit, but it also takes time. And I've seen it with you guys, right? It's like, I didn't, when I first was aware of you guys, I didn't know you were DJs. I didn't have a clue. Like, I just thought you're singer-songwriters and you can write great records. Happy days for you. I didn't know there was a bigger goal of the DJ, and because the story wasn't being told. But now it is, and you're fucking sick DJs, and you're touring now. And it's been really nice from afar to, like, even since, like, hanging out with you on ship and like actually seeing like, damn, it's actually working. Like, they've said what they wanted to do and it's actually working. And however long that takes, it doesn't matter, because it will, we know it'll get there.
I actually remember that. It's so interesting you said that, because it kind of didn't, you know, there wasn't loads of shows flooding in post, there was shows, but like we weren't known as DJs, so they couldn't really book us because they didn't know we were DJs. So you were kind of having to explain to people what the show looks like, and then maybe there's like a singing element. That was a bit confusing for people. And then we were in a session with Frankie Wah, up north, writing just stuff for his stuff and for our stuff. And he basically just, I won't, you know, bore you with all the details, but he basically opened our eyes up to like how intentional you have to be with like all that side of stuff. He's like, so what do you guys want to do? And we were like, and you know what, he's like, I don't know if you've ever met him, he's very like stern, he's very like focused.
Yeah, just do that.
Present.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he's like, so what do you want to do? And we were like, well, we want to do this. And he's like, well, then you need to do this. And we're like, oh, okay. And he's like, yeah, so what's your touring like? Do you just do shows in the UK? Oh no, we don't really get booked in the UK, it's mainly Europe. He's like, right, well, if you want to get on a UK festival, you need to prove to the festival that you have a fan base, and that means going around and scooping up, you know, club shows in the UK, and then you'll get booked at Creamfield because you can sell tickets for Creamfield if you're on the lineup. Yeah. And you're like, and then, you know, it just took someone to sit down and actually explain it to us and be like, ah, and there's ways to be proactive. It's not like we'll just keep being in the studio and wait on a hit, and we'll be in the studio and wait to like start to do numbers, and we'll work on our graphics and our photos and all that crap. It's like, no, you can just go out and like, you can press bookers and you can call people and you can be like, hey man, can I support you? Like, he literally loaded up. He was like, who's your booker? And our booker at the time was X, let's say. Yeah. And then he was like, right, who's your guy? Found the guy. He was like, oh, he has all these clients. And then he clicked on a client. And then he was like, okay, go away and find out where all these people are touring at the moment.
Yeah.
And then we went and found out who was touring, and one of them was a big artist. And then we got like, was it like 12 dates, Josh, or something? Like,
I think it ended up being even 16.
Yeah, we pressed the booker and just said, can we go on support? And then, you know, there was a negotiation. And then, but it just happened because he was like, you're just sat here and you could be doing way more. And it was like, ah, yeah.
It's so true. It's so true. And I think there's comes a point where it's actually really hard to, I think it's, as artists, it's very easy to just go to like, I'll blame my agent that I'm not being successful in certain markets, blame this, blame that. And it, you need a level of, you need something to be able to go, yeah, it makes sense for you to be on that show, right? Like, you're not necessarily, like, if you're just kind of a nobody coming in and you can't, you're not going to get that situation. You need a milestone in your career to have had that. You guys had that. It makes sense for you to be able to go out and push bookers to do that. But it also takes a level of, like, just being in the booker's mind, being in the agent's mind. Agents, in, especially in UK and Europe, I don't want to talk shit, but, like, they're not, they don't work how they do in America. American agents are just on another level of business.
Oh my gosh,
they're the fucking best. It's just completely different. But I think you're 100% right. And look at Frankie's career, like, in a comparison, like, COVID, I didn't know him before COVID. Like, he had that Come Together record, and that's when I know of him. We literally released the same week, and look where he's at now. He's way bigger than I am in a level of selling tickets and streams, and he's, from what I see, he's been doing it for 4 years.
Yeah, he changed his, he kind of like didn't change his sound, but he really went hard at, like, you know, that sound became really popular, like melodic techno, and then he was like releasing like whole albums on his own label. And I was like, I mean, I remember, like, it was kind of just locked down or just after, and he was kind of like telling us people who'd already agreed to release on his label, but his label didn't exist yet. And I remember just being like, what do you mean? Like, how have you even done that? And he was just like, yeah man, you just gotta like, just, you gotta ask. Do it. And I was like, yeah, it's and I think you can rest on your morals sometimes and go, oh well, I'm an artist, and like you say, I've got all these people who take money to do it for me, so therefore I don't have to do the work, when the reality is you're gonna have to do it yourself to an extent, and you should go out and just, do you know what I mean, like, go do it yourself, and then loop people in, and, you know, it probably won't just happen for you. Like, that's probably going to be a graft element.
It never will. I don't think anyone I don't think it happens for anyone. Even, yeah, I don't see it ever doing that. Like, I've seen it with artists where, like, they've been stuck in that rut for so many years and then they just decide to do something new. They move to Berlin, they move somewhere and, like, just to hustle. And it's like, that's the hustle. You take a year, 2 years of hustle with you guys, like 3 to 6 years of just hustling, and then eventually it clicks. And then there comes a point when you're in that stage where you're like, I'm just coasting, and then you have to hustle again. And then,
and like, even at the top level, like, that's happening. Do you know?
100%.
This is a massive name drop, but it's actually a useful point. I'm not just doing a name drop. I got invited to go and stay with David Guetta in Ibiza. Mm. And, like, he is at the top of the game, like, in terms of selling tickets. He doesn't need to be hustling. And he had 3 studios on the go in his house.
Yep.
Like, with live-in producers, and was flying in top liners for, like, 3 days at a time for the entire summer. And so if you think about, like, even he is hustling like that to get, you know, to get hit records. It's crazy that what we need to be doing.
I think you're 100% right. These people are successful for a reason. They're, like, whether you like the music or not, that's completely irrelevant, right? Mm. But these people are successful for a reason. And I think that is a really apparent thing that people just don't realize a lot of the time, is you just fucking have to work really hard.
Yeah. It's so worky.
You're not being, nobody's being given it.
No, nobody.
It's so worky. And it's also now, like, workier than ever because it's so competitive. And, like, the one thing that I've been trying to, like, say to people really recently is that even if you're not seeing the level of success that you want to see right now, there's something about the universe, call it whatever you want, there's no, like hard work just doesn't go unnoticed, and it isn't in vain. So even if you just graft and graft and graft for 10 years and you don't have that success, it will manifest itself in some which way, whether you discover a business idea along the way or it's not in music, blah 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 blah. But if you graft, there just always is. I've seen too many people completely beast us for work rate and watch them become successful and go, fully, like, not like James Hype, for one. Just when James was following up More Than Friends, he'd had a big moment, he'd released like 2 more records, and then lockdown happens, and he just, like, even when he came to a writing camp, I think we hosted once at Universal, and I remember him telling me about his day, and it was like a Wednesday, and it was like, yeah, man, I've been to the gym. I'll do this session. I'll go home. I'll do some stuff for the weekend, like mix it. And then I'll, and then he was telling me about how, like, he organizes his evening. It was like, oh, I do all, like, my stuff I really don't want to do first. Like, I'll, all my, like, programming for my DJ sets and all that sort of stuff. And then I'll do, like, creative stuff that I enjoy. And then he's like, yeah, and I'll probably finish like 3-4 in the morning.
Yeah.
And then I'll go to bed, and then I'll wake up, I'll go to the gym, I'll do all again. And I remember sat there in the session being like, you knew all that today. I'm going home after this session. I'm going to go to sleep, probably eat some food. But, like, then the proof is in the pudding, and he's doing what he's doing now. And I'm like, yeah, it's just graft. Like, it's so much work.
I do think it's important to say, because, like, from the outside looking in, people might listen to this conversation and go, like, oh, yeah, good boys. But it's easy for you to say that because your first song went big. And whilst that's true, the real truth is that we had been writing songs for, you know, 5 years before that that had never been heard by anybody. And I can remember our other mate, Connor Blake, he's an incredible songwriter. He wrote Piece of Your Heart, Lose Control, Paradise, a whole load of other songs we've written together. And me and him were sat in this little studio that somebody was letting us use. And we'd done like 40 songs together over the period of 18 months. A load of them were crap. And we were sat there and we're like, we've got these songs that are finished and are done, and we think they're really good. And then there's the radio And I just don't know what's in the middle. Like, I just don't understand how you make that link. And we just went through, like, everybody that we knew who had any kind of tenuous link to the music industry. And this is the real life story of how it happened. And Connor, like, knew somebody that, like, was somehow related to Capital Radio. I think he was, like, doing the DJing, but not the presenter. He was DJing while somebody else presented, sort of behind the scenes. And then we sent the songs to him, and we sent the songs that day to, like, 30 people. And then this guy, who's an absolute legend, is called Nathan. He, like, knew one of the guys from Medusa, like, from years ago, and sent the demos to him. And that's how it happened for us, is, like, essentially is we did loads of graft, and then one day we're just like, hang on a minute, how can we get these songs to a person in the music industry, and just scattergunned. And very blessed and very grateful to Nathan that sort of happened.
And I think that is the crux of this whole conversation, really, isn't it? Is that put the work in, you have to be good as well. Like, you can put the work in, you can still be shit, right? Like, at the end of the day. But, like, maybe go do something else. But I think it's, you make your own luck.
100%. Yeah, and people sometimes play as a song, and then they go, what do you think of that? And you're like, yeah, it's good. You got anything else? And they're like, oh, no, like, I really like this one. Mm. And you're like, come on. Like, let's sit, park it, let's make more while you don't have an outlet for that one, or maybe you do, like, let's get it out. But, like, I think when you first start, like, you know, even I did this, and I'm sure you guys have done it to an extent, like, you make something, you're really happy with it, you're really proud of it, and then you stay there, and you're like, how do I, this is really good, what do I do with it? And you're like, no, you need to, like, you know, keep making more of it, and you'll probably make something better, and the chances are it isn't that good.
Yeah, when you listen back in, like, 6 months' time, you're like, oh, that's so embarrassing. Like, I can't believe I played that to somebody.
Yeah,
it's products at the end of the day, and I think what a lot of people don't think, because we're artists, it's like, don't look at it as a product. And in the business world, it is purely a product, right? It's like, how many cars did Henry Ford design to get to the Ford Escort, right? Yeah. Like, how many failures did they have to get through to get to the point where it was the most successful car company in the world? And it's how many bad songs do you have to write to get that one good song? And
so many.
It's so easy to write an average song. So easy.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. It's like easy. So, like, we're writing average songs every single fucking day. Like, I did three yesterday where you're just like, they're good. They could pass. They could get released. Yeah. They're not going to do fuck all, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
But to get to that one record that does do well, which you don't ever know if it is going to be that record, like, you've got to try it. Got to
put it. I famously had a conversation with someone who works at a record label, and they asked about a song, and I said, they were like, if we put it out, do you think it will be big? And I said, well, I usually would say, which is, because, like, there's an element of self-promotion where you could be like, yeah, man, this is a smash hit, like, it's going to be great. And I just felt in the moment to be really honest, and I was like, I don't know, man.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. And then he was like, but what was it like before Piece of Your Heart? And I said, same feeling, no idea. Yeah, but you've heard Piece of Your Heart before it came out, you heard Loose Control before it came out, you heard even Ferrari before it came out, and you've heard, like, songs before they came out. Was there, like, I'm like, yeah, I just think it's good, man. Like, I don't know what else to tell you. There is no algorithm, there is no thing. I sometimes, like, joke to Josh, like, there's a 13-year-old boy that lives inside of me, who I try and, this sounds so weird, but I try and harness that energy.
It's 13-year-old Ethan, to be clear. Yeah. It's not anybody else. It's 13-year-old you.
I don't have a 13-year-old boy in my house. So there's, like, this 13-year-old on the inside who I'm trying to, like, does he have this gutty jerk reaction to a record and go, ah, something happened there, I like that. that's usually about as close to like amazement when you work in the music industry as you can if you can tap into what you're actually feeling the first time you hear a record, because you can never hear it for the first time ever again. So you just need to put yourself and go, that thing that I felt, did it do a tiny thing? Yeah, that's probably something that it will do to most people.
Yeah,
and that's about as good a gauge as you get. Like we were in a session once with a writer called Arrow Benjamin, and he did the Running record with Beyonce and loads of other stuff for her. And he's an insane person to speak to. He's very cool, and we are not cool. And I remember we were writing a song, and like you said, Will, it was like bang average, it was fine. And he was just really honest, and he was like, there's no moment, we should move on.
Yeah.
And I remember being like, what do you mean? And he was like, well, we haven't created a moment within the song.
Yeah.
So any hit record that you've ever heard has got a moment within it where you go, cool. And whether it's a cool like underlick, or whether it's a cool hook, or whether it's like with Piece of Your Heart, it was the like stop the record dead. There's a moment of which catches your attention. And I think that's about all you can do to chase a record and go, I think that that's good. But the ultimately, I've got no bloody idea what we're doing.
I love that.
Still don't.
I love that. And I think this is the most perfect way to end this. We've just done an hour and a half.
Lads. Really?
Yeah, it's fucking gone quick.
Whoa.
Thanks for coming on, lads. I really, really appreciate it. How can people follow you? How can people get involved with the Good Boys movement? And how do people do that? Tell the people. Tell the people what they want to know.
Josh, you're good at it.
You can follow us. You can follow us on Good Boys at Good Boys OFF on all socials. And if you check us out on YouTube, we've got a couple of mixes that we're uploading every couple of months in beautiful locations. And we'll see you somewhere around the world soon.
Sick. Nice one, lads. Thanks so much for coming on. Catch you soon.
Thanks for having us, man. Appreciate it.
Big love.
See you, mate.
Stay on. And that's a wrap. Big love to the lads for coming on. Really enjoyed that conversation. It was a very insightful conversation. Hope you enjoyed it. Please share it. Please give us a review. And see you next time. Big love. Keep safe.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.